From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, a new WBUR poll on the challenge facing anyone hoping to unseat Governor Charlie Baker or Senator Elizabeth Warren.
Charlie Baker and Elizabeth Warren, as of now, are prohibitive favorites in 2018.
Also today, convictions dismissed in a troubling case of prosecutorial misconduct in Western Massachusetts. And a new biography seeks to rescue John W. McCormick from political oblivion. The powerful Boston-born politician rose to become Speaker of the House and oversaw the transformation of the Democratic Party. So why have we forgotten him?
He did not want to be Speaker of the House. He did not want a biography. And there's a very simple reason for this, and that was he invented a life history, which was to get elected in Massachusetts.
Plus, remembering Mitchell Chester, the state's commissioner of elementary and secondary education, who died last night at the age of 65. That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks, and we'll begin today with a new WBUR poll that finds the state's two best-known politicians in pretty strong positions as they face re-election next year. Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren and Governor Charlie Baker have approval numbers that most politicians only dream of, according to our poll. 55% of registered voters that we polled in the state view Warren, the Democratic senator, favorably. Baker, the Republican governor, has even better numbers, 64%. Give him favorable marks. Now, it goes without saying that Election Day is a long way off and a lot can happen between now and then. But the poll does suggest that their challengers face some pretty steep climbs in the months ahead. Steve Cazella is president of Mass Inc. Polling. He conducted the WBUR poll for us and joins us now. Hi, Steve. Good to see you.
Good to be here.
So it seems like the headline here is Governor Baker. Tell us a little bit about his numbers. They're good as ever, even stronger than ever, right?
Yes, as has been true since he was elected, Charlie Baker remains very popular. As you said, 64% view him favorably, just 15% unfavorably, still great numbers. We've also seen those numbers for his approval rating, asking how whether people approve or disapprove of the job that he's doing. Those numbers have been good throughout his term. Also, for the first time, we matched him up against some of the Democrats considering or have already decided to run against him, and found there that he holds quite a sizable lead among the three Democrats that are already in the race.
So the three Democrats we're talking about, Newton, Mayor Seti Warren, Jay Gonzalez, the former finance chief for Governor Deval Patrick, and Bob Massey, the entrepreneur and environmentalist. So roughly how far ahead or how far behind are these three?
Right. So those three are each about, it's somewhere in the 30-point range, so 27 to 30 points behind.
All right.
Not terribly surprising. None of them are particularly well-known yet. So when you look at their favorable numbers, we're talking about, you know, 8, 9, 10%. Unfavorable is about, you know, in that same range. So most voters have not, either haven't heard of them at all or don't have an opinion yet of Governor Baker's potential challengers.
Now, you find that Baker also does very well among Bay State Democrats, right?
Right. Well, that's what's interesting. So throughout his term, he's been very popular among Democrats in terms of whether they approve of the job he's doing or whether they like him. But we also included Maura Healey in this poll. And the really interesting thing to me is that among Democrats, 57% view Baker favorably. But when you match him up against Maura Healey, 28% of Democrats say that they would support Baker. So there's a lot of Democrats out there, a lot of voters out there who do like Charlie Baker, who do approve of the job he's doing, but would consider voting for Democrat next year.
Interesting. So one of the question that this poll raises, and I've talked to you about in the past about this, the sort of this idea, can anyone beat Baker, who's described because a number of polls have found this, that he's the most popular governor in the country. So here's Steve Crawford, a Democratic activist, who says to this question, yes, he can be beaten. And he points to the defeat of question two last November, the ballot measure that would have lifted the cap on charter schools, which Baker supported. So here's Steve Crawford.
Of course he's beatable. Question two was written, campaign was managed by Baker and the Baker team. They did the same thing on question two that they're doing now. And we have lots of money that we're going to spend and we're going to win. They got crushed.
So, Steve, I brought that up because remind us about some of the recent history and how unstable poll numbers like this can be as time moves forward.
Right. So I think the most direct parallel, of course, is Scott Brown, who in 2011, when just before Elizabeth Warren got into the race, was seen in some ways similar to how Baker is seen now. You know, very popular. Why would anybody even think of running against him? You know, that was sort of the situation. And actually, two of the three Democrats who were considering running against him were two of the same three Democrats that are now challenging Baker. So there's a lot of parallels there. His favorables are very high, and of course we know what happened. And then you look back at Deval Patrick, and in early 2010, he had very low favorables, very low approval rating, and of course went on to win re-election in 2010. So you know, just being popular this far ahead doesn't necessarily say anything about re-election, particularly when there are so many voters, as we've seen in this poll, who are willing to say, yes, I like Charlie Baker, but I am considering voting for Maura Healey, or once these other challengers become better known, I'd consider voting for one of them.
All right. Well, let's move on and talk about Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, who's facing a possible challenge from Republican State Rep Jeff Deal of Whitman. What did the full poll find about her approval ratings?
Right. So her favorables are about where they have been. You know, she's had roughly the same numbers since she was elected. There's about a third of voters, sometimes a little higher, sometimes a little lower, who have not liked Elizabeth Warren or held a favorable view of her since she was first elected in 2012. But when you match her up against Jeff Deal, she actually does quite well. So she's leading him right now by about a 2-to-1 margin, 60% for Elizabeth Warren, 29% for Jeff Deal. She actually does better than her favorables numbers, which is similar actually to how 2012 unfolded, where Scott Brown was liked, had better numbers, better favorable numbers than Elizabeth Warren, even on election night, and she still won by 8 points.
All right. So Warren staying in the news lately focusing on national issues. She's doing a lot of town hall meetings, expressing her opposition to the Trump administration. Here she is recently in Worcester talking about Republican efforts to repeal and replace Obamacare.
It's yours. You get your plan together and see how it works. And you come explain to the American people how 24 million of them lost coverage. You come explain to the families all over my state that have lost a loved one to opioids, how you're going to suck $5 billion out of treatment. You go explain that. It's not my job. That's their job to explain.
All right. There's Elizabeth Warren in Worcester a few weeks ago. By the way, there's news on that. The U.S. Senate is going to delay the vote on the health care bill because the votes just aren't there. But, Steve, clearly, you know, Warren is going to want to nationalize this race, run against President Trump. So talk about what we know, what the poll says, how that might work. I mean, how is Trump viewed in the state?
Right. So those numbers have also been fairly consistent. Trump, in the sense that Trump is very unpopular in Massachusetts. It's, I'm sure, surprising no one. So 28% view Donald Trump favorably, 65% unfavorably. So far more people view him unfavorably. And pertinent to that quote, I'd say, views of the health care bill nationally and all the state polls I've seen show that that the bill is quite unpopular. So in running against Trump or campaigning against Trump and the health care bill, I'd say she's sort of picking two easy targets for voters in Massachusetts to latch on to.
All right, Steve Cozzella, president of MassInc Polling, stick with us because I want to introduce Joan Vinocchi of the Boston Globe. She wrote today about Charlie Baker, so I want to go back to Baker and sort of zero in. And Joan, welcome to Radio Boston.
Nice to be here.
Yeah, and you wrote today that when it comes to health care, you said Baker could own this issue on the national stage if he chose to, but you suggest he's not doing that in a really robust way. Sort of lay that out. What's going on there?
Well, Charlie Baker is being Charlie Baker, which means that he's being careful and cautious and circumspect and threading the needle. And I guess if I were a campaign consultant and not a columnist, I would say he's doing the right thing given his poll numbers. On the other hand, Trump is kind of the wild card in all this. Think about 2018 when Charlie Baker is running for re-election for governor and Elizabeth Warren is running for re-election for U.S. Senate. And Jeff Deal, who is a basic virtual unknown, the state senator who is says he's going to be running against Warren, says he's going to bring in Trump to Massachusetts. Which side does Charlie Baker want to be on, particularly with health care? So I think he has nothing to lose by being bold, and he's got a lot of political capital to burn right now.
So let me sort of try to throw the other side there. And, you know, I've talked to folks who support Baker, and they say, come on, cut the guy some slack. He's a Republican, and, you know, and he's got to work with the Trump administration. And by the way, he's made it clear that he didn't support Trump, and he does oppose, for example, the Senate health care bill. This week he talked about how, or he at least put out a statement about how much money would be lost, Massachusetts would lose. So isn't that enough for a Republican governor?
I suppose so. But then look at John Kasich in Ohio. He's a Republican governor. Yes, he has a different agenda. Yes, he's got a U.S. Senator, Rob Portman, who's a Republican. But he's come out and said that this is a time when you choose country over party. And I think with health care, which is an issue that Charlie Baker knows better than anybody else, that he should be passionate about, that he could be passionate about, that he should be passionate about it.
Do you think this is political calculation on Charlie Baker's part, or is he just the kind of politician who just isn't the sort of hot-blooded, passionate type? I mean, I don't think I've ever... I mean, I've seen Charlie Baker express himself in ways that make me believe he believes what he's saying, but he's not one of those throw the red meat out there type of politicians.
I think it's both. I mean, it's calculation that sort of does fit his persona.
Yeah.
But, you know, to give him a little bit of the benefit of the doubt on the passion equation, and I've been tough on him on this before, I mean, he's made the opioid fight kind of a signature cause of his gubernatorial tenure so far. So he does have some passion for the idea that the vulnerable need access to health care. And if he kind of channeled that a little bit, I would say he could up his passion quotient a bit.
So, Steve Cazella, let me bring you sort of as the pollster back into this conversation, because it seems to me that Charlie Baker has a very delicate balancing act here. And if he goes a little too, well, I'll just for the sake of this conversation, on Joan's side of the equation, he could risk alienating a bunch of Trump supporters in Massachusetts. And doesn't he need those voters come to 2018?
I think it depends on whether or not we take what he says are his targets as what are actually his targets in terms of voters. So there was a Globe article a few weeks back where he said he was targeting around a third of registered Democrats in the state, which if that's true, if that's actually his target, then that suggests that he's anticipating losing a good number of Republicans. You know, Republicans hardly they usually win some Democrats,
yeah,
maybe 20%, 25%. If he wins a third, that means that he can afford to lose a lot of Trump supporters, a lot of registered Republicans.
Yeah. And what do you think about that, Joan? I mean, in terms of this, if he's being cautious and needs to calculate about not losing that part of the Republican base that is sympathetic to Trump.
Well, I'm not a numbers person. I'm just thinking, what if a Maura Healey got in the race? Yeah. What if a Marty Walsh got in the race?
Yeah.
What if a true blue Democrat that is not going to hold back on talking about health care or immigration or all the things that Charlie Baker is being so cautious about? What if someone like that got in the race? Then I think these poll numbers mean nothing right now.
Yeah.
And you know, the only poll that counts is the one that's taken on election day.
Well, you know, I'd love to sort of go back to the beginning here and talk to you really quickly, Joan, about these poll numbers that Steve was talking about. Do they surprise you? Or, I mean, do you think, I mean, as you say, the only poll that matters is election day. But what do you make of this extraordinary number that seems to be remarkably durable so far when it comes to Charlie Baker's popularity?
I think Charlie Baker, people have a lot of faith in his management skills, and they're giving him time and the benefit of the doubt to set things right that he said he would set right, like the T, all his other promises along the management line. And that's his strong suit. But those polling numbers, as Steve pointed out, Democrats who like him could be persuaded to switch if the right Democrat were in the race. Right now, it doesn't look like the right Democrat is, but that could change.
Steve, two more quick questions for you about the polls. I know we also did the WBR poll, looked at least a couple of the ballot questions, beginning with the so-called millionaire's tax. This would raise taxes on incomes over $1 million. What did the poll find?
Right. And there we've seen in poll after poll that support is somewhere in the mid-70s. This one even found even up to the low 80s. This one found it at 81% support, 15% opposed. So a lot lot of support out there for this idea. This is obviously before a real campaign gets underway, you know, so you can see these numbers tighten up. But at this early stage, very high support for that idea.
And what about the proposal to reduce the state sales tax from 6.25% to 4.5%, so down almost two full percentage points?
Right. And this is one where we actually don't know exactly what the final proposal would be. So we picked one of the ones that's been out there, or one of the ranges that's been out there. We found 62% would support the idea, and 29% now say they would oppose the idea of reducing the sales tax. This one, even more than fair share, the millionaire's tax, is still largely unknown. You know, this is a concept we're sort of introducing in a poll. So I think what it tells you is that people are predisposed to hear the consider the idea of lowering the sales tax. But needless to say, as with all of the questions in this poll, there's a long way to go and a lot of learning that voters will have to do about this.
Yes, please, Joan.
Can I just make a Baker point about those numbers? Poor Charlie Baker. He has to be against the millionaire's tax and for bringing down the sales tax when he needs revenue, particularly if, by some measure, Trump care passes and we lose all that money. So that also puts him in a tough spot.
Interesting. More delicate balancing on the part of the Bay State governor. Joan Vinaki, Boston Globe columnist. You can find a link to her column today at radioboston.org. Joan, thanks for coming in.
Nice to be here.
And Steve Cozzella, president of Mass Inc. Polling. You can find a link to the WBUR poll at radioboston.org as well. Steve, always a pleasure. Thank you for your work and thanks for coming in.
My pleasure.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Two former state prosecutors are being accused of misconduct in connection with a state drug lab scandal in Western Massachusetts. The case involves former state drug lab chemist Sonia Farrick, who stole and used the drugs she was supposed to be testing in the lab in Amherst. Yesterday, a judge threw out seven convictions connected to Farrick and found that the two prosecutors deliberately concealed documents about the extent of Farrick's drug use while on the job. We'll hear from one of the defense attorneys in a moment, but first we're joined by WBUR senior reporter David Boeri, who's been following this story. David, good to have you in here.
Thanks, Anthony.
So explain the full extent here about Sonia Farrick and what she was doing at the lab.
So she's a state chemist at the drug lab in Amherst, and during the course of some 8 years, she swallowed, snorted, siphoned, and smoked her way through a whole larder of crack, weed, LSD, ecstasy, and the rest of it. It was sort of like a Bob's Big Boy. She kept on going, piling her plate. But this is terribly serious because she stole and switched samples. Yeah. And there's as many as 18,000 cases that public defenders estimate could be linked to her and were all considered tainted by her certifications.
Unbelievable. So now, how did her drug use come to light?
Well, this is fascinating because she's arrested in early 2013. In her car, the car's a mess. The police investigators searching the car, they find drugs, drug paraphernalia. They also found in the whole mess a mental health diary that she had been keeping because she was dealing with her own secret drug addiction and she was receiving treatment for it. It provided a clue that when pursued would lead back to this devastating find. But prosecutors sat on the evidence of what it was for 22 months, and they fought disclosure of that evidence even to a criminal defense attorney, Luke Ryan, and they accused him of being on a fishing expedition.
Mm. Now, to a lot of listeners, this might sound familiar to another case, so I just want to be very clear that this is separate from the Annie Duquesne scandal, the former chemist at the state lab in Jamaica Plain who falsified drug tests in order to get convictions.
Separate from it, although Farrick worked with her for a time in the Jamaica Plain lab. But it was the Duquesne scandal. It was in full mode when the arrest of Farrick took place, and it was Attorney General Martha Coakley, then the Attorney General, who had assured the public that this new scandal was a small one, unlike Duquesne. It was a scandal of just a few weeks. But the evidence I was talking about found in the car was a discovery that Farrick had been using drugs since 2004. So instead of being a four-week scandal, it was an 8-year scandal.
Wow, wow. So tell me about the two former assistant attorneys general there, Ann Kaczmarek and Chris Foster. What are they specifically accused of doing?
So deliberately concealing documents and making misrepresentations to the court, which is a nicer way of saying lies to the court. Chris Foster had told a judge that all the relevant materials had been turned over. She hadn't even checked the files. She was relying on what she said she'd been told from people above her. And so that's hers. And meanwhile, Kaczmarek led the prosecution of Farrakh, and she knew about the worksheets. She told a state police sergeant who found the documents not to talk about them in the grand jury. And above and all that, you also have a Kaczmarek note to the state police sergeant who says, who says, and she's dreading another scandal, please don't let this get more complicated than we thought. Here's defense attorney Jared Olenoff, who says the attorney general ensured that a scandal devolved into a travesty of justice.
To find out now, that years later, that they were hidden from me is a really low-down, dirty thing that you don't see too often in this practice. But when you do, it's harmful. It's harmful to everybody. It's harmful to the system as a whole.
David, we should point out that we did reach out to Attorney General Maura Healey's office about this. We wanted to get a comment since obviously these assistant attorneys general overseen by her office, they did not return our request for a comment. But have we heard anything from the Attorney General's office?
No. And, you know, you're wondering because two attorney generals, their offices are involved in this. You'd like to hear from Maura Healey that, in fact, she disapproves of what happened. But their tendency was to defend. In fact, the Maura Healey's assistants were defending the case last December during those hearings that Richard Carey conducted. They wanted to minimize the role of the attorney general's office and blame the two underlings, but they argued that it was too small, that their infractions weren't worth throwing everything out for.
And have we heard anything from the two assistant attorneys general, Ann Kaczmarek and Chris Foster? Have they commented on this?
Kaczmarek has denied these. She's claimed that the report is wrong. She is an assistant magistrate. We haven't heard from Foster yet.
All right. Well, let me bring in from Northampton, Northampton defense attorney Luke Ryan. He played a key role in bringing this evidence to light. Luke Ryan, good to have you on Radio Boston. Thanks for joining
us. Thanks for having me.
So can you just sort of go back a little bit and sort of tell us how this all started? Why did you start digging into this? What were the circumstances that led to these revelations?
Sure. So at the time of Ms. Farrakh's arrest, I represented a client who had a pending drug case, and we received reports that had been written by the state police and had been disclosed from the Attorney General's office indicating that, as David mentioned, they had searched Ms. Farrakh's car, and in the back they found what they termed assorted lab paperwork. So I and a number of other attorneys who represented defendants sought access to this assorted lab paperwork. We tried doing it informally through requests to the Attorney General's office. When that didn't get anywhere, we filed motions. At every corner, we were essentially told this was irrelevant evidence. We were on a fishing expedition. And a judge ultimately made a finding based on the evidence before him back in 2013 that Ms. Farrakh's misconduct, while egregious, didn't begin until the summer of 2012. So one of the justifications that they cited for not letting us see the evidence was the pending criminal prosecution against Ms. Farrakh. When that concluded in January of 2014, I happened to be representing another individual who was charged with a drug crime and sought access to the evidence again and said, hey, you told me last time I couldn't see it because the case against Ms. Farrakh was pending. It's not pending anymore. And eventually I was able to get a court order for that allowed me to go to Boston and look at the evidence myself. And back on October 30th, 2014, I did that, and that's when I discovered the mental health worksheet that David referred to.
Yeah. And how surprised were you by what you found from the prosecutors?
It was pretty shocking, but it wasn't like a needle in a haystack. I mean, there was some 300 pieces of paper in the car and dozens of them related to this treatment that she was getting for a drug addiction. So it was shocking because it had immediate impact on these cases. The present one that I was representing, as well as these past ones, where relief had been denied to my clients. But it was also shocking because it seemed clear that anybody who had given a look at this evidence would have immediately seen that it was exculpatory to my clients and should have been turned over.
And Luke, you know, characterize the extent of this potential misconduct here. I mean, what does it mean in term to a defense attorney who's trying to defend folks? I mean, how serious is this? How do you characterize what's happened here?
Well, you know, there's a constitutional obligation that all prosecutors have to, and it's kind of counterintuitive. It's an adversarial system, but the lawyers who represent the state have this obligation to turn over evidence that could actually hurt in their case, that would make it more difficult for them to achieve their objective. So it puts them in this position where they know that if they don't do it, it's unlikely that anybody's ever going to learn about it. And it's this moral hazard that exists for prosecutors who are more interested in winning a conviction than serving justice. So this case, I think, illustrates this fear that many of us in this system have as to the things that can happen where prosecutors are in possession of things that really go to the crux of a case, and we're trying to figure out the truth. We're trying to reach a just result, and we don't have all of the available information to do that.
Right. David, how frequent is there this kind of prosecutorial misconduct? I mean, do you have a sense of that? I know
misconduct is very, very hard to find. And by the way, this is why Luke Ryan is a hero for having dug up and fought for this evidence for months. Were it not for Luke Ryan, this would not have come out. He fought and fought and fought. Robert Jackson, the U.S. Attorney General, way back in 1940, commented that the prosecutor has more control over life, liberty, and reputation than any other person in America. His discretion is tremendous. Now, the thing is, you know, defense attorneys are supposed to be zealous advocates, but the calling of the prosecutor is not, as Luke pointed out, is not to win convictions, it's to do justice. A sitting judge out in the Ninth Circuit Federal Court of Appeals in San Francisco, his name is Alex Kaczynski, he writes that prosecutors and their investigators have unparalleled access to the evidence, both inculpatory and exculpatory. And while they are required to provide exculpatory evidence to the defense, it's very difficult for the defense to find out whether the prosecution is complying with this obligation. And the whole system, Anthony, requires the disclosure of exculpatory information. If it isn't done, the system of justice fails.
Luke, could this have been an honest mistake, as one of the prosecutors says?
The short answer is no. I mean, they had one of the as David said, you know, this is kind of a rare case. We obtained literally thousands of internal emails of the Attorney General's office, and this was not evidence that anybody overlooked. They had discussed this evidence on numerous occasions and how to treat it and what to do with it. And it was really the only, I mean, Sonia Farrick denied the allegations against her. She, unlike Annie Dukin, when she was confronted, she didn't confess. She lawyered up. And so this evidence of her own writing, talking about how she tried to resist using but at work but ended up failing, that was in the back of her car, what was critical evidence in the case against Ms. Farrakh, and it would have been immediately apparent, and was immediately apparent to the people who were prosecuting her and who knew about the evidence, that it had a role or to play in these other matters involving drug defendants like my clients.
And Anthony, this was made worse because the Attorney General's office, there are good guys in this story, prosecutors, local prosecutors out there in Hampden County, who, if they had had the information that the Attorney General had, they would have distributed to defense attorneys across the board, so people would have found out about this. But since the Attorney General's kept the local prosecutors out of the loop, they didn't know, so this didn't come forward until Luke Ryan got on the case. Mm.
So, David, does this go beyond two prosecutors, or is there a larger issue at play here?
Well, this is the Attorney General's office. That's not to say that the judge characterizes the two as the center of it, the heart of it. However, it occurs within the Attorney General's office. When you defend the behavior, when you minimize the damage done, it does damage across the system. So, Maura Healey, it's important that she speak on this issue rather than, in fact, issue no statement and say it's under review. The obligation is on her and Coakley to respond.
All right. So, Luke, I mean, I guess one of the big questions here is who polices the prosecutors to make sure they hand over information to defense attorneys like you?
It's a really important question. It's something that I think courts across the country are struggling with. I mean, David referenced that decision written by the chief judge of the Ninth Circuit back in 2013, and that caused quite a stir. I mean, he, in his view, he said Brady violations have reached epidemic proportion in recent years. And he went on and he cited about a dozen cases from the state and federal level. And so there's a lot of, I think, proposals that are underway to deal with this problem. In some places, they've proposing open file discovery. But it's a real danger because I said at the outset that there's prosecutors become invested in obtaining convictions in many cases, and it puts them in a position of having a real conflict. And there's a lot of ethical ones out there who do the right thing and give up evidence that hurts their case, but they unfortunately, when they don't do that, it's very difficult to find out.
Well, that's Northampton defense attorney Luke Ryan. Luke, thanks so much for joining us today. We're very grateful to you.
Thanks for having me.
And WBUR senior reporter David Boeri, you can find links to his reporting on all of this at radioboston.org. David, always good to have you. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Anthony.
Stay with us. Coming up, we're going to remember Mitchell Chester, Commissioner of Elementary and Secondary Education, who died last night. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Mitchell Chester, the state commissioner of elementary and secondary education, died unexpectedly last night at the age of 65 after a battle with cancer. He leaves behind a wife and five children. Chester is being remembered today for his contributions to the state's public education system. Here's Paul Sagan, chairman of the Massachusetts Board of Elementary and Secondary Education.
It's easy to forget that we didn't always have the best schools, public schools in the country. And Mitchell is a big reason that we have such great schools, and he still came in fired up all the time to try to make places even better, to make good schools great and schools that aren't doing what we want, to make them really good.
Governor Charlie Baker called Mitchell Chester a dedicated educator and an accomplished public servant who helped make our public school system a national leader. We're joined now by Paul Revel, who knew Mitchell Chester well. Paul is a professor at the Harvard Graduate School of Education and the former Secretary of Education for the state of Massachusetts. He served as chairman of the State Board of Education, which hired Mitchell Chester. And Paul Revel, thanks for coming back on Radio Boston. And I'm very sorry for your loss, for the loss of Mitchell Chester's family. And I know this is a tough time.
Well, thank you, Anthony. We're all mourning Mitchell Chester today. He was such an important figure in terms of the development of public education in Massachusetts, and he was such a central figure in his large family, and so it's a tremendous loss to all of us and came somewhat by surprise. And to see someone of this stature sort of plucked from life, still in his prime when he was ready to, I think, enjoy the fruits of his labors after all these years, really feels like a tragedy today.
Yeah, I can understand that. Commissioner Chester was one of the longest-serving education commissioners in the country, I learned today. He had served since 2008. Yep. So I think it's fair to sort of talk about a legacy. I mean, how would you characterize his legacy in Massachusetts?
Well, I think there are many things that he'll be remembered for. He came in at a time of change in Massachusetts. He came in a new Democratic administration when Deval Patrick was here, although it was an appointment by the board. The system of education governance was changing, so he navigated that. We used to joke because when he took the job, there was no Secretary of Education, and then the legislature passed a reorganization, and suddenly I, who'd been chairman of the board, was now Secretary of Education, and he had a new layer of government to deal with in addressing the executive branch. He dealt very well with that. No sooner had he got settled than the Great Recession hit, and where he had a lot of great ideas about what he wanted to do in the department, he found himself presiding over a great many cuts. You know, during that period, he was able to lead our Race to the Top application, and ultimately we had the top-scoring application in the country in that competition. And that was due to his leadership and stewardship and the department that he built. I mean, he continued the work that prior commissioners had done, but it really accelerated the development of a department that was not so much compliance-oriented as it was service-oriented, helping out the school districts, the schools, and the educators in the field. So he built a very powerful department, professionalized that department, attracted a lot of top-level talent. He'll be remembered for the work up in Lawrence and some of the school turnaround work in places like Springfield and Holyoke and Southbridge, where he's really had a great deal of power, but used that power with great restraint, included a lot of unconventional partners like charter schools and community-based organizations in that work. He navigated the sort of icy political shoals of Common Core and Park and found a good middle ground on that and guided Massachusetts through that and emerged himself as a national leader in education circles. So there's a lot for which Mitchell Chester's family ought to be very proud of what he's done here in the Commonwealth.
Well, Paul, you raised the professional, and you started by making reference to the personal as well. In the 30 seconds or so we have left, I know that you considered him a friend.
Right.
So tell us what Mitchell Chester meant to you as a person and a friend.
Well, first of all, he was a very caring guy. He would always be concerned and ask about family and about somebody else's welfare, and he remembered what was going on in your life and genuinely cared about it. I guess what I most admired about him was he had a kind of gyroscope, and that gyroscope kept him on balance. He was a really serious guy about education, but he kept focused on fairness. He kept focused on evidence of what's best for children. And he kept himself on a pathway that had integrity. And that I really admired.
All right. Well, that's Paul Revel. He teaches at the Harvard Graduate School. I'm sorry, that's Paul Revel. He teaches at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. He served as Secretary of Education for Massachusetts. And he was remembering his friend Mitchell Chester, the State Commissioner of Elementary and Secondary Education, who died last night at the age of 65. And Paul, thanks again for joining us. And thanks for helping us to remember Mitchell Chester.
Well, thank you for remembering him, Anthony. I really appreciate it.
He was a very private man in very public office. That's how biographer Garrison Nelson describes John W. McCormick, a politician from South Boston who won 22 consecutive elections to Congress, worked under six presidents, from Franklin Roosevelt to Richard Nixon, and rose to become Speaker of the House during an extraordinary transformation of the Democratic Party. And yet, if not for the buildings that bear his name in Boston, McCormick is largely forgotten.
That was the plan. He did not want to be Speaker of the House. He wanted to be majority leader under Sam Rayburn, a man he adored, and certainly probably the most important speaker of the 20th century. He did not want a biography. And there's a very simple reason for this, and that was he invented a life history, which was to get elected in Massachusetts.
Garrison Nelson is a professor of law and politics at the University of Vermont who has rescued McCormick from political oblivion by writing John W. McCormick, A Political Biography. Nelson says McCormick invented a life history that he was all Irish, but he wasn't. His father was of Scottish descent. But Nelson said McCormick had a loud-mouthed, hard-drinking bootlegger brother named Nocco, who helped create the fiction that the reserve teetotaler McCormick was pure Irish.
Oh, he was a bootlegger, he was a leg breaker. Anytime you needed a nasty deed done, you called on Knocko McCormick. One time he clocked the head of the mayor of Boston, Morris Tobin. But Knocko was crucial because Knocko filled every single anti-Irish stereotype. Back in the day, there were only two routes to success in Boston. You had the sort of the Yankee Brahmin route, where you had to have a Puritan, a Pilgrim ancestor, and had to go to Harvard in order to succeed, you know, clearly be a Protestant. And John's father was not only not born in Boston, wasn't born in Ireland, he was born in Canada, born in Prince Edward Island.
So he wasn't pure Irish, and you say his prospects for political advancement would have been seriously derailed if this had been fully known, right?
If your father was a Scot, yeah, which his father was. And so the contrast between John and Knocko are just staggering. And Knocko, as I say, a big, burly, you know, loudmouth guy, whereas John was, was quiet, never without a suit, never without a clean white shirt, looked like a Presbyterian minister, quite frankly. So Knocko basically provided the Irish cover for John.
So McCormick was first elected to Congress in 1928. He rose through the ranks, worked under the great Speaker Sam Rayburn, and would go on to become Speaker. But first, tell us about what kind of congressman he was and about the political dynamics that he encountered in Washington.
He came into a Democratic Party, which is wholly controlled by the South. And the Democratic Party in 1924 had been overwhelmingly defeated, got less than 30% of the vote in the presidential election. So the Democratic Party was clearly on the ropes.
I see. And so McCormick helped sort of forge that alliance between what would become urban Democrats and Southern Democrats, which really gives new life to the Democratic Party, right?
Absolutely. And helped in large part by Franklin Roosevelt. And in 1940, when Will Bankhead, the Speaker of the House, died, Sam Rayburn was elevated to the speakership, and John McCormick was elected majority leader. And Sam Rayburn and John McCormick were the two top Democrats in the House for the next 21 years, never had a vote against them in the caucus.
Now, McCormick is elected Speaker in 1962, and you write that he became a real master of the inside game. So what kind of Speaker was he?
John was a man who basically let others take credit. Roosevelt, Truman, Kennedy, and especially Johnson take credit. He was always in the room. He was always in the room when decisions were made, but he made very little effort to sort of put himself out front. He plays a very important role, for example, in the atomic bomb of funding in 1944. He actually plays a role in Kennedy's nomination. He's kind of undermined Kennedy's vice presidential bid in 1956, but in 1960 he was named by Kennedy himself to be in charge of Kennedy's convention operation. Joe Kennedy, who has basically intimidated both Jack Kennedy and John McCormick, wanted Lyndon Johnson to be on the ticket. And the only way he got Lyndon Johnson on the ticket was to get Sam Rayburn to approve it. And the only person from Massachusetts that Sam Rayburn listened to was John McCormick.
Interesting.
And, of course, without Johnson on the ticket, John Kennedy is not elected president.
It's really interesting, this relationship between McCormick and the Kennedys. You have a great story about John F. Kennedy. When he decided to give up his House seat and run for the Senate, he said, "I no longer wish to be bored by John McCormick."
That was a direct quote from Kennedy's old government professor, Sam Beer, who shared that with me one afternoon.
Yeah, really, really, really interesting. So talk a little bit about some of the extraordinary events that he oversaw, that he was in the room for, essentially, when he was Speaker, because it was quite a time in our history.
When Jack was murdered in 1963, John was, of course, the Speaker of the House, was next in line behind the Vice President. So now Johnson becomes President and McCormick is next in line. And McCormick is absolutely horrified because, you know, it's the last thing in the world he wants, of course, to be next in line. But he was the Speaker during the Great Society Congress, and which passed, you know, Medicare, Medicaid, immigration reform, and, of course, a Civil Rights Act. So he was, in the chair when all these massive Lyndon Johnson reforms took place. And Lyndon Johnson had a success rate of 93% in the House when John was Speaker.
Wow. So I want to come back to this theme of why he isn't really remembered and why he's faded into relative political oblivion. David Shribman, who used to write for the Boston Globe, is now executive editor of the Pittsburgh Post, gave your book a wonderful review. but I just want to read one part of that review. He said, I've covered politics for the better part of 40 years, and I cannot recall McCormick's name being mentioned even once since Richard Nixon was president. The best that can be said for him is that McCormick was in the room when so many decisions and events of consequence occurred, a zealot without much zeal or zest. Is that fair?
Yeah, that's very fair. Yeah. Now, it was crucial. He had a wonderful memory. He was very smart, even though he was, you know, unschooled, only had eighth grade education. But he didn't drink, and when everyone else in the room was drinking, so consequently, the morning after, John was the only one who could actually tell them what happened in the prior night.
He was the only one without a hangover.
You got it.
Another thing I want to ask you about. So in a 1935 Boston Globe interview, McCormick said, quote, I have no hesitancy in insisting that government in an emergency, do everything that can be reasonably done to relieve human suffering and distress. And you call him the moral compass of the House of Representatives for his modesty, frugality, and integrity. That sounds like a pretty impressive legacy, especially when viewed through today's political lens.
Well, John, you have to understand, when John was moving up in politics, the two most dominant figures in Boston politics were John Francis Fitzgerald, a.k.a. Honey Fitz, Jack Kennedy's maternal grandfather, and his great rival for power, James Michael Curley. Fitzgerald had a flirtatious nature and was rumored to have had sort of adulterous affairs. Jim Curley didn't cheat, but Jim Curley stole from the public treasury. So McCormick had these two negative role models, and he made sure that he didn't cheat and didn't steal, and that's why I say the moral compass.
Interesting. Garrison, you spent 20 years writing this biography. Well, the first thing I want to say about that is congratulations on finishing it. But my question is why? Why did you want to write this story and devote two decades of your life to it?
Well, I met him. I met him in 1968. I had just been hired as a brand new instructor at the University of Mon. I was all of 26 years old. I was writing my dissertation on leadership of the House of Representatives. I went down to the American Political Science Association national meeting in Washington, D.C. that year, and I went over to the Capitol Hill, you know, went into the Speaker's office, and I said, I'm a graduate student at the University of Iowa. I'm writing a dissertation about leaders of the House. Is there anyone I can talk to about Speaker McCormick? And his chief of staff said, would you like to talk to Speaker McCormick? I said, of course. So he brought me into his office and sat down. And so I started asking him questions. So there I am, 26 years old, smoking a cigar in the sumptuous office of the Speaker of the House, a giant chandelier, me and the 76-year-old Speaker puffing away, talking about politics. Yeah, this is what you call a sort of seminal moment in my life.
So there you are, a young college kid working on your dissertation, smoking a cigar with him. Did you like him? Was he
a
nice presence?
Very nice. He was very, very unassuming. So I've been in the presence of multiple politicians, and I know the ones who are unassuming and the ones who basically you know want you to sort of pay deference to them. John was not in that category. Very, very modest, as they say, and easy to talk to. Now, I never expected to write the book about McCormick. I kept waiting for somebody to write the book, and years would pass, and no one would write the book. Finally, in 1995-96, I was on sabbatical in Boston, and I went to the office of Eddie McCormick, the Speaker's nephew, and I said I'm writing a book called The Austin-Boston Speakership Connection. I'm writing a chapter about your uncle. He said, why don't you write a book about my uncle? And he had withheld 6 boxes of material from the Boston University archives, which I did not know about. But Eddie was on his last legs and would die basically the following year. And one of his last requests was that I be given these 6 boxes of material.
Wow.
I had already uncovered the trail of through public documents, church records and birth and death certificates and so forth, and census records. So I'd already put together the story. But when I got these boxes, I opened up. Then I got everything I needed.
In recalling John McCormick and the way he conducted politics, the way he ran the House, does he offer any lessons for today?
Yes, he was unfailingly polite. His worst insult for a person was to say, I hold the member in minimum high regard. That was his, that was the extent of his criticism. There was a time when they got along in the House when Joe Martin, who was a Republican Speaker of the House from North Attleboro, was dumped as a leader in 1959. Joe Martin went over to Sam Rayburn's office to tell Sam, and Sam was in the middle of having a birthday party, and Joe Martin and Sam Rayburn cried on each other's shoulders. I mean, here you have the leading Democrat, the leading Republican, crying on each other's shoulders. I mean, that's a degree of comity which you just don't see today.
Well, Garrison Nelson, he's a professor of law, politics, and political behavior at the University of Vermont. His new book is John William McCormick, A Political Biography. Garrison Nelson, thank you so much.
Thank you, Anthony.
All right, and that's it for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Our program is produced by Kathleen McNerney, Jamie Bologna, and Allison Bruzek, with help from Caitlin O'Keefe and Sean Bowden. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Anthony Brooks. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.